Welcome to the Beatitudes by Thomas Watson. We are continuing to read at page 142 for this reading. This Reformation MP3 audio resource is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. Many Free Puritan and Reformed resources, as well as our complete online catalog containing classic and contemporary Reformation books, digital downloads, MP3s, videos, DVDs, CDs, and a Puritan hard drive at great discounts, are on the web at puritandownloads.com. Also, please consider and pray and act upon the important truths found in the following quotation by Charles Spurgeon. Quote, as the apostle says to Timothy, so also he says to everyone, give yourself to reading. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read. Renounce as much as you will all light literature, but study as much as possible sound theological works, especially the Puritanic writers and expositions of the Bible. The best way for you to spend your leisure is to be either reading or praying. End of quote. If you'd like to be added to our email list, please send an email to swrb@swrb.com with the word add in the subject line. Our email list is a double opt-in list, so once you've sent us your email address, you'll be asked by email to confirm that you want to join our list using the email address that you have supplied. Your email information will be kept confidential, and you can easily remove yourself from our email list by simply emailing us at swrb@swrb.com with the word remove in the subject line. Once you're on our email list, you'll be alerted to all the new free Reformation resources, free MP3s, free electronic books and texts, etc., that SWRB makes available on the web, as well as, at times, to our best discounts and super specials. We also encourage you to reproduce this audio resource and to pass it on to your friends, but we only authorize this as long as the full contents of the message, including the header and trailer, is not altered in any way, and as long as the audio file is given away for free. And now to SWRB's reading of the Beatitudes by Thomas Watson, which we hope you find to be a great blessing and which we pray draws you nearer to the Lord Jesus Christ. For he is the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father but by him. John 14:6. As I said, we're on page 142. We're beginning, actually, a new chapter, chapter 15 in the book. This chapter is called A Discourse of Mercifulness. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Matthew 5:7. These verses, like the stairs of Solomon's temple, cause our ascent to the Holy of Holies. We are now mounting up a step higher. Blessed are the merciful. There was never more need to preach of mercifulness than in these unmerciful times wherein we live. It is reported in the life of Chrysostom that he preached much on this subject of mercifulness, and for his much pressing Christians to mercy, he was called of many the alms preacher, or the preacher for mercy. Our times need many Chrysostoms. Blessed are the merciful. Mercy stands both in the van and rear of the text. In the beginning of the text, it stands as a duty. In the end of the text, it stands as a reward. The Hebrew word for godly signifies merciful. The more godly, the more merciful. The doctrine I shall gather out of the words which will comprehend and bring in the whole is this, that the merciful man is a blessed man, as there is a curse hangs over the head of the unmerciful man. Let Satan stand at his right hand. When he shall be judged, let him be condemned. And let his prayer become sin. Let his children be fatherless and his wife a widow. Let his children be continually vagabonds and beg. Let the extortioner catch all that he hath. Let strangers spoil his labor. Let there be none to extend mercy to him. Let his posterity be cut off, and in the generation following let their name be blotted out. Let the iniquity of his fathers be remembered with the Lord, and let not the sin of his mother be blotted out. Psalm 109, verses 6 to 9. Now, what is this crime? Because he remembered not to show mercy, verse 16. See what a long vial full of the plagues of God is poured out upon the unmerciful man. So by the rule of contraries, the blessings of the Almighty crown and encompass the merciful man. The merciful man is a blessed man, 2 Samuel 22:26, Psalm 37:26, Psalm 41:1. For the illustrating this, I shall show first what is meant by mercifulness, second, the several kinds of mercy. The nature and source of mercifulness. First, what is meant by mercifulness? I answer, it is a melting disposition, whereby we lay to heart the miseries of others and are ready on all occasions to be instrumental for their good. How do mercy and love differ? In some things they agree, in some things they differ, like waters that may have two different spring heads but meet in the stream. Love and mercy differ thus. Love is more extensive. The diocese that love walks and visits in is larger. Mercy properly respects them that are miserable. Love is of a larger consideration. Love is like a friend that visits them that are well. Mercy is like a physician that visits only them that are sick. Again, love acts more out of affection. Mercy acts out of a principle of conscience. Mercy lends its help to another. Love gives its heart to another. Thus they differ, but love and mercy agree in this. They are both ready to do good offices. Both of them have soundings of boughs and healing under their wings. Whence does mercy spring? Its spring head rises higher than nature. Mercy, taken in its full latitude, proceeds from a work of grace in the heart. Naturally, we are far enough from mercy. The sinner is a bramble, and not a fig tree yielding sweet fruit. It is the character and sign of a natural man to be unmerciful, Romans 1:31. A wicked man like Jehoram has his bowels fallen out, 2 Chronicles 21:19. Therefore he is compared to an adamant, Zechariah 7:12, because his heart does not melt in mercy. Before conversion, the sinner is compared to a wolf for his savageness, to a lion for his fierceness, Isaiah 11:6, to a bee for his sting, Psalm 118:12, to an adder for his poison, Psalm 140, verse 3. By nature, we do not send forth oil, but poison. Not the oil of mercifulness, but the poison of maliciousness. Besides that inbred unmercifulness which is in us, there is something infused, too, by Satan. The prince of the air works in men, Ephesians 2:2. He is a fierce spirit, therefore called the red dragon, Revelation 12:3. If he possesses men, no wonder if they are implacable and without mercy. What mercy can be expected from hell? So that if the heart be turned into mercifulness, it is from the change that grace has made, Colossians 3:12. When the sun shines, the ice melts. When the sun of righteousness once shines with beams of grace upon the soul, then it melts in mercy and tenderness. You must first be a new man before a merciful man. You cannot help a member of Christ till you yourself are a member. Secondly, the several kinds of mercy are how many ways a man may be said to be merciful. Mercy is a fountain that runs in five streams. We must be merciful to the souls, names, estates, offenses, and wants of others. Mercy is to be extended to the souls of others. This is a spiritual alms. Indeed, soul mercy is the chief of mercies. The soul is the most precious thing. It is a vessel of honor. It is a bud of eternity. It is a sparkle lighted by the breath of God. It is a rich diamond set in a ring of clay. The soul has the blood of God to redeem it, the image of God to beautify it. It being therefore of so high a descent sprung from the Ancient of Days, that mercy which is shown to the soul must needs be the greatest. This soul mercy to others stands in four things. First, in pitying them. If I weep, says Augustine, for that body from which the soul is departed, how should I weep for that soul from which God is departed? Had we seen that man in the gospel cutting himself with stones and fetching blood of himself, it would have moved our pity, Mark 5:5. To see a sinner stabbing himself and having his hands imbrued in his own blood should cause relenting in our bowels. Our eye should affect our heart. God was angry with Edom because he cast off all pity, Amos 1:11. Soul mercy is in advising and exhorting sinners. Tell them in what a sad condition they are, even in the gall of bitterness. Show them their danger. They tread upon the banks of the bottomless pit. If death gives them a jog, they tumble in. And we must dip our words in honey. Use all the mildness we can. In meekness, instructing those, 2 Timothy 2:25. Fire melts. Ointment mollifies. Words of love may melt hard hearts into repentance. This is soul mercy. God made a law that whosoever saw his enemy's donkey lying under a burden, he should help him, Exodus 23:5. On which words, says Chrysostom, we will help a beast that is fallen under a burden? And shall we not extend relief to those who are fallen under a worse burden of sin? 3. Soul mercy is in reproving refractory sinners. There is a cruel mercy when we see men go on in sin and we let them alone. And there is a merciful cruelty when we are sharp against men's sins and will not let them go to hell quietly. Thou shalt not hate thy brother in thine heart. Thou shalt in any wise rebuke thy neighbor and not suffer sin upon him. Leviticus 19:17. Fond pity is no better than cruelty. Rebuke them sharply, cuttingly, Titus 1:13. The surgeon cuts and lances the flesh, but it's in order to a cure. They are healing wounds. So by cutting reproof when we lance men's consciences and let out the blood of sin, we exercise spiritual surgery. This is showing mercy. Others save with fear, pulling them out of the fire, Jude 23. If a man were in the fire, though you did hurt him a little in pulling him out, he would be thankful and take it as a kindness. Some men, when we tell them of sin, say, oh, this is bitterness. No, it's showing mercy. If a man's house were on fire and another should see it and not tell him of it for fear of waking him, were not this cruelty? When we see others sleeping the sleep of death and the fire of God's wrath ready to burn about their ears and we are silent, is not this to be accessory to their death? 4, soul mercy is in praying for others. This is like physique used in a desperate case, and often it recovers the sick patient. The effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much, James 5:16. As it cures the sick body, so also the sin-sick soul. There is a story of one who gave his soul to the devil, who was saved through the prayers of Luther. When Eutychus fell down from a high loft and was taken up dead, Paul fell on him. That is, he effectually prayed over him, and he prayed him alive. Acts 20:9-12. By sin, the soul is fallen from a high loft, namely, a state of innocency. Now fervent prayer oft-times fetches life in such a dead soul. See what a blessed work the work of the ministry is. The preaching of the word is nothing but showing mercy to souls. This is a mighty and glorious engine in the hand of the Lord of hosts for the beating down of the devil's strongholds. The ministry of the word not only brings light with it, but eye salve, anointing the eyes to see that light. It's a sin-killing and soul-quickening ordinance. It is the power of God to salvation. What enemies are they to their own souls that oppugn the ministry? They say, the people that live under the line curse the sun and are glad when the sun sets because of its burning heat. Foolish sinners curse the sun rising of the ministry and are offended at the light of it because it comes near their sins and scorches their consciences, though in the end it saves their souls. Reproofs now for such as have no mercy to souls. It reproves them that have no mercy to souls, evil magistrates, evil ministers, evil magistrates who either take away the key of knowledge, Luke 11:52, or give a toleration to wickedness, suffering men to sin by a license. The meaning of toleration is this, that if men will themselves to hell, none shall stop them. Is not nature enough poisoned? Do not men sin fast enough, but must have such political engines as serve them up higher in wickedness? Must they have such favorable gales from the breath of great ones as serve to carry them full sail to the devil? This is far from soul mercy. What a heavy reckoning will these statists have in the day of the Lord. Evil ministers are such as have no mercy to the souls of their people. They do not pity them or pray for them. They seek not them, but theirs. They preach not for love, but lucre. Their care is more for tithes than for souls. How can they be called spiritual fathers who are without mercy? These are mercenaries, not ministers. Such men feed not the souls of their people with solid truths. When Christ sent out his apostles, he gave them their text and told them what they must preach. Preach, saying the kingdom of heaven is at hand, Matthew 10:7. Upon which place, says Luther, the ministers of Christ must preach things that pertain to the kingdom of God, pardon of sin, sanctification, living by faith, not otherwise at the bidding of the church. They are unmerciful to souls who, instead of breaking the bread of life, fill their people's heads with airy speculations and notions, who rather tickle the fancy than touch the conscience and give precious souls rather music than food. Some there are who darken knowledge with words and preach as if they were speaking in an unknown tongue. Some ministers love to soar aloft like the eagle and fly above their people's capacities, endeavoring rather to be admired than understood. They're like some crabbed authors which cannot be read without a comment. Indeed, God calls his ministers ambassadors, 2 Corinthians 5:20. But they must not be like those outlandish ambassadors that cannot be understood without an interpreter. It is unmercifulness to souls to preach so as not to be understood. Ministers should be stars to give light, not clouds to obscure the truth. St. Paul was learned, yet plain. Clearness and perspicuity is the grace of speech. It is cruelty to souls when we go about to make easy things hard. This many are guilty of in our age, who go into the pulpit only to tie knots and think it their glory to amuse the people. This savors more of pride than mercifulness. Such there are, too, as see others going on in sin but do not tell them of it. When men declare their sin as Sodom, it is the minister's duty to lift up his voice like a trumpet and show the house of Jacob their sin, Isaiah 58:1. Zeal in the ministry is as proper as fire on the altar. He who lets another sin and holds his peace is a manslayer. That sentinel deserves death who sees the enemy approaching and gives not warning, Ezekiel 3:20. Some ministers poison souls with error. How dangerous is the leprosy of the head! A frenzy is worse than a fever. What shall we say to such ministers as give poison to their people in a golden cup? Are not these unmerciful? Others there are, unworthy the name of ministers, itineraries, the devil's journeymen, who ride up and down and with Satan compass the earth to devour souls. It would pity one's heart to see poor, unstable creatures misled by rude and illiterate men who diet the people with blasphemy and nonsense and make them fitter for bedlam than the New Jerusalem. All these are unmerciful to souls. Let me beseech all that fear God to show soul mercy. Strengthen the weak, reduce the wandering, raise up them that are fallen. He which converteth the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death, James 5:20. Christians must be tender of one another's names. Yes, we must be merciful to the names of others. A good name is one of the greatest blessings upon earth. No chain of pearls so adorns as this. It being so, we ought to be very tender of names. They are to be accounted in a high degree unmerciful, who make no conscience of taking away the good names of their brethren. Their throats are open sepulchres to bury the fame and renown of men, Romans 3:13. It is a great cruelty to murder a man in his name. The keepers of the walls took away my veil from me, Canticles 5:7. Some expositors interpreted of her honor and fame, which covered her as a beautiful veil. The ground of this unmercifulness to names is first pride. Pride is such a thing as cannot endure to be outshined. It loves not to see itself exceeded in parts and eminency. Therefore it will behead another in his good name, that he may appear something lower. The proud man will be pulling down of others in their reputation, and so by their eclipse he thinks he shall shine the brighter. The breath of a proud man causes a blast or mildew upon fame. 2. Envy, 1 Peter 2:1. An envious man maligns the dignity of another, therefore seeks to mischief him in his name. Religion teaches us to rejoice in the esteem and fame of others. I thank my God for you all, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. It is divulged with fame, Romans 1:8. A good report is a credit to religion, Hebrews 11:2. If persons professing godliness do not have a good name, religion will not have a very good name. But envy, consulting with the devil, lays a train and fetches fire from hell to blow up the good name of another. In how many ways may we be unmerciful to the names of others? Diverse ways. First, by misreporting them. A sin forbidden. Thou shalt not raise a false report. Exodus 23:1. Eminency is commonly blasted by slander. Their tongues are as arrows shot out. Psalm 64:3. The tongue of a slanderer shoots out words to wound the fame of another and make it bleed to death. The saints of God in all ages have met with unmerciful men who have fathered things upon them that they have not been guilty of. Sirius, the Jesuit, reported of Luther that he learned his divinity of the devil and that he died drunk. But Melanchthon, who wrote his life, affirms that he died in a most pious, holy manner and made a most excellent prayer before his death. It was David's complaint, they laid to my charge things which I knew not, Psalm 35:11. The Greek word for devil signifies slanderer, 1 Timothy 3:11. Not slanderers in the Greek, it is not devils. Some think that it is no great matter to defame and traduce another, but no, this is to be acting the part of a devil. Oh, how many unmerciful men are there who indeed pass for Christians, who play the devil, inventing their lies and calumnies. Wicked men in Scripture are called dogs, Psalm 22:16. Slanderers are not like those dogs which licked Lazarus' sores to heal them, but like the dogs which ate Jezebel. They rend and tear the precious names of men. Valentinian, the emperor, decreed that he who was openly convicted of this crime of slander should die for it. And Pope Gregory decreed that such a person should be excommunicate and not have the communion given him. I think it was a just decree. Second, we are unmerciful to the names of others when we receive a slander and then report what we hear. Thou shalt not go up and down as a talebearer among thy people, Leviticus 19:16. A good man is one that doeth not evil to his neighbor, nor taketh up a reproach against his neighbor, Psalm 15:3. We must not only not raise a false report, but not take it up. To divulge a report before we speak with the party and know the truth of it is unmercifulness and cannot acquit itself of sin. The same word in the Hebrew, to raise a slander, signifies to receive it. Exodus 23:1. The receiver is even as bad as the thief. It is well if none of us have, in this sense, received stolen goods. When others have stolen away the good names of their brethren, have not we received these stolen goods? There would not be so many to broach false rumors, but that they see this liquor pleases other men's taste. Third, we deal unmercifully with the names of others when we diminish from their just worth and dignity, when we make more of their infirmities and less of their virtues. Speak not evil one of another, James 4:11. I've read a story of one, Idor, an abbot, that he was never heard to speak evil of any man. Augustine could not endure that any should eclipse and lessen the fame of others. Therefore he wrote these two verses upon his table. Whoever loves another's names to blast, this table's not for him, so let him fast. Wicked men are still paring off the credit of their neighbors, and they make thick parings. They pare off all that is good. Nothing is left but the core, something they may tend to their disparagement. Unmerciful men know how to boil a quart to a pint. They have a devilish art so to extenuate and lessen the merit of others, that it's even boiled away to nothing. Some, though they have not the power of creation, yet they have the power of annihilation. They could sooner annihilate the good which is in others than imitate it. Fourth, we are unmerciful to the names of others when we know them to be calumniated, yet do not vindicate them. A man may sometimes as well wrong another by silence as slander. He who is merciful to his brother is an advocate to plead in his behalf when he is injuriously traduced. When the apostles who were filled with the wine of the Spirit were charged with drunkenness, Peter vindicated them openly, Acts 2:15. A merciful man will take the dead fly out of the box of ointment. Fifth, they are in a high degree unmerciful to the names of others who bear false witness against them. Psalm 27:12. Put not thy hand with the wicked to be a false witness. Exodus 23:1. Putting the hand is taking an oath falsely, as when a man puts his hand upon the book and swears to a lie. So Tostatus explains to us this false witness is a two-edged sword. The party forsworn wounds another's name and his own soul. A false witness is compared to a maul or a hammer, Proverbs 25:18. It's true in this sense, because he is hardened in impudency. He blushes at nothing and in unmercifulness. There's no softness in a maul or a hammer, nor is there any relenting or mercy to be found in a false witness. In all these ways, men are unmerciful to the names of others. Let me persuade all Christians, as they make conscience of religion, so to show mercy to the names of others. Be very tender of men's good name. Consider what a sin it is to defame any man, laying aside all envies and evil speakings, Titus 3:2, 1 Peter 2:1. Envy and evil speaking are put together, laying aside, putting away, as a man would put away a thing from him with indignation, as Paul shook off the viper, Acts 28:5. Consider also the injuriousness of it. You who take away the good name of another, wound him in that which is most dear to him. Better take away a man's life than his name. By eclipsing his name, you bury him alive. It's an irreparable injury. Something will remain. A wound in the name is like a flaw in a diamond or a stain in azure which will never die out. No physician can heal the wounds of the tongue. God will require it at men's hands. If idle words must be accountable for, shall not reproachful slanders? God will make inquisition one day, as well for names as for blood. Let all this persuade to caution and circumspection. You would be loath to steal the goods of others. A man's name is of more worth, and he that takes away the good name of another's sins more than if he had taken the corn out of his field or the wares out of his shop. Especially take heed of wounding the names of the godly. God has set a crown of honor on their head, and will you take it off? Wherefore then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses, Numbers 12:8? To defame the saints is no less than the defaming of God himself, they having his picture drawn upon them, and being members of Christ. Oh, think how ill Christ will take this at your hand another day. It was under the old law a sin to defame a virgin. And what is it to calumniate Christ's spouse? Are the names of the saints written in heaven, and will you blot them out upon earth? Be merciful to the names of others. And then mercy is to be extended to the estates, offenses, and wants of others. Be merciful to the estates of others. If a man be your debtor, and providence has frowned upon him that he has not wherewithal to pay, do not crush him when he is sinking, but remit something of the rigor of the law. Blessed are the merciful. The wicked are compared to beasts of prey that live upon spoil. They do not care what mischief they do. He lies in wait secretly as a lion in his den. He doth catch the poor when he draweth him into his net. Psalm 10:9. Chrysostom says the drawing into the net is when the rich draw the poor into bonds. And in case of non-payment at the day, the bond being forfeited, seize upon all that they have. It's not justice but cruelty when others lie at our mercy. To be like that hard-hearted creditor in the gospel who took his debtor by the throat saying, "Pay me what you owe." Matthew 12:18-28. God made a law. No man shall take the nether or the upper millstone to pledge, for he taketh a man's life to pledge. Deuteronomy 24:6. If a man had lent another money, he must not take both his millstones for a pawn. He must show mercy and leave the man something to get a living with. We should in this imitate God, who in the midst of anger remembers mercy. God does not take the extremity of the law upon us, but when we have not to pay, if we confess the debt, he freely forgives. Proverbs 28:13, Matthew 18:27. Not but that we may justly seek what is our own, but if others be brought low and submit, we ought in conscience to remit something of the debt. Blessed are the merciful. And we must be merciful to the offenses of others. Be ready to show mercy to them which have injured you. Thus Stephen, the proto-martyr, he kneeled down and cried with a loud voice, "Lord, lay not this sin to their charge." Acts 7:60. When he prayed for himself, he stood. But when he came to pray for his enemies, he kneeled down, to show, says Bernard, his earnestness in prayer, and how greatly he desired that God would forgive them. This is a rare kind of mercy. It is a man's glory to pass over a transgression, Proverbs 19:11. Mercy in forgiving injuries, as it is the touchstone, so the crown of Christianity. Bishop Cranmer was of a merciful disposition. If any who had wronged him came to desire a courtesy from him, he would do all that lay in his power for him, insomuch that it grew to a proverb, "Do Cranmer an injury, and he'll be your friend as long as he lives." To overcome evil with good and answer malice with mercy is truly heroical and renders religion glorious in the eyes of all. But I leave this and proceed. We must be merciful to the wants of others. This the text chiefly intends. A good man does not, like a snake, twist within himself. His motion is direct, not circular. He is ever merciful and lendeth, Psalm 37:26. This merciful charity to the wants of others stands in three things. First, a judicious consideration. Blessed is he that considereth the poor, Psalm 41:1. And you must consider four things. First, it might have been your own case. You yourselves might have stood in need of another's charity. And then how welcome and refreshing would those streams have been to you. Secondly, consider how sad a condition that poverty is. Though Chrysostom calls poverty the highway to heaven, yet he that keeps this road will go weeping thither. Consider the poor. Behold their tears, their sighs, their dying groans. Look upon the deep furrows made in their faces, and consider if there be not reason why you should scatter your seed of mercy in these furrows. For a cloak he has a tattered vesture, for a couch a stone. The poor man feeds upon sorrow. He drinks tears, Psalm 85. Like Jacob, in a windy night he has the clouds for his canopy and a stone for his pillow. Nay, further, consider that oftentimes poverty becomes not only a cross, but a snare. It exposes to much evil, which made Agur pray, "Give me not poverty," Proverbs 38. Want puts men upon indirect courses. The poor will venture their souls for money, which is like throwing diamonds at pear trees. If the rich would wisely consider this, their alms might prevent much sin. Consider why the wise God has suffered an inequality in the world. The wise God has done this. It is for this very reason, because he would have mercy exercised. If all were rich, there were no need of alms, nor could the merciful man have been so well known. If he that traveled to Jericho had not been wounded and left half dead, the good Samaritan who poured oil and wine into his wounds had not been known. Had Ilium stood, who'd known of Hector's name? Consider how quickly the balance of providence may turn. We ourselves may be brought to poverty, and then it will be no small comfort to us that we relieved others while we were in a capacity to do it. Give a portion to seven, and also to eight, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth, Ecclesiastes 11:2. We cannot promise ourselves to have good days always. God knows how soon many of us may change our pasture. The cup which now runs over with wine may be filled with the waters of Marah. I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty, Ruth 1:21. How many have we seen invested with great lordships and possessions who have on a sudden brought their manor to a morsel? Suddenly he becomes Iris, who was formerly a Croesus for wealth. So that it is wisdom in this sense to consider the wants of others. Remember how soon the scene may alter. We may be put in the poor's dress, and if adversity come, it'll be no trouble of mind to us to think that while we had an estate, we laid it out upon Christ's indigent members. This is the first thing in mercifulness, a judicious consideration. Secondly, a tender commiseration. If thou draw out thy soul to the hungry, Isaiah 58:10, bounty begins in pity. The Hebrew word for mercy signifies bowels. Christ first had compassion on the multitude. Then he wrought a miracle to feed them, Matthew 15:32. Charity which lacks compassion is brutish. The brute creatures can relieve us in many ways, but cannot pity us. It's a kind of cruelty, says Quintilian, to feed one in want and not to sympathize with him. True religion begets tenderness. As it melts the heart in tears of contrition towards God, so in bowels of compassion towards others. My bowels shall sound as a harp, Isaiah 16:11. Likewise, when our bowels of pity sound, then our alms make sweet music in the ears of God. Third, mercifulness consists in a liberal contribution. If there be a poor man within thy gates, thou shalt open thy hand wide unto him, Deuteronomy 15:7-8. The Hebrew word to disperse, Psalm 112:9, signifies a largeness of bounty. It must be like water that overflows the banks, not a meager dispersing of a mere trifle. If God has enriched men with estates and made his candle, as Job says, to shine upon their tabernacle, they must not encircle and engross all to themselves, but as the moon, which, having received its light from the sun, lets it shine to the world. The ancients, as Basil and Laurinus observe, made oil to be the emblem of charity. The golden oil of mercy must, like Aaron's oil, run down upon the poor, which are the lower skirts of the garment. This liberal disbursement to the wants and necessities of others, God commands, and grace compels. Yes, God commands. There's an express statute law. If thy brother be waxed poor and fallen in decay with thee, then thou shalt relieve him. Leviticus 25:35. The Hebrew word is, thou shalt strengthen him. Put under him a silver crutch when he is fallen. It is worth our observation what great care God took of the poor, besides what was given them privately. God made many laws for the public and visible relief of the poor. The seventh year thou shalt let the land rest and lie still, that the poor of the people may eat. Exodus 23:11. God's intention in his law was that the poor should be liberally provided for. They might freely eat of anything which grew of itself this seventh year, whether of herbs, vines, or olive trees. If it be asked how the poor could live only on these fruits, there being, as it is probable, no corn growing then, for answer, Cajetan is of opinion that they lived by selling these fruits and so converting them into money lived upon the price of the fruits. There's another law made. When you reap the harvest of your land, thou shalt not wholly reap the corners of thy field. Neither shalt thou gather the gleanings of thy harvest, Leviticus 19:9. See how God indulged the poor. Some corners of the field were for the poor's sake to be left uncut. And when the owners reaped, they must not go too near the earth with their sickle. The Vulgate Latin reads it, thou shalt not shear to the very ground. Something like an aftercrop must be left. The shorter ears of corn and such as lay bending to the ground were to be reserved for the poor, says Tostatus. And God made another law in favor of the poor. At the end of 3 years, thou shalt bring forth the tithe of thy increase the same year, and thou shalt lay it up in thy gates. And the Levite, and the fatherless, and the widow, which are within thy gates, shall come, and shall eat, and be satisfied. Deuteronomy 14:28-29. The Hebrews write that every third year, besides the first tithe given to Levi, which was called the perpetual tithe, Numbers 18:21, the Jews set apart another tithe of their increase for the use of the widows and orphans. And that was called the tithe of the poor. Besides, at the Jews' solemn festivals, the poor were to have a share, Deuteronomy 16:11. And as relieving the necessitous was commanded under the law, so it stands in force under the gospel. Charge them that are rich in this world that they do good, that they be rich in good works, 1 Timothy 6:17-18. It's not only a counsel, but a charge, and non-attendance to it runs men into a gospel problem. Thus we have seen the mind of God in this particular of charity. Let all good Christians comment upon it in their practice. What benefit is there of gold while it is embowed and locked up in the mine? What is it the better to have a great estate if it be so hoarded and cloistered up as never to see the light? As God commands, so grace compels to works of mercy and beneficence. The love of Christ constrains, 2 Corinthians 5:14. Grace comes with majesty upon the heart. Grace does not lie as a sleepy habit in the soul, but will put forth itself in vigorous and glorious actings. Grace can no more be concealed than fire. Like new wine, it will have vent. Grace does not lie in the heart as a stone in the earth, but as seed in the earth. It will spring up into good works. Then a vindication of the Church of England and its doctrine of good works. This doctrine may serve to justify the Church of England against the calumny of malevolent men. Julian upbraided the Christians that they were Salafidians, and the Church of Rome lays upon us this aspersion that we are against good works. Indeed, we plead not for the merit of them, but we are for the use of them. Let ours also learn to maintain good works for necessary uses, Titus 3:14. We preach that they are needful both as they are enforced by the precept and as they are needful for the general good of men. We read that the angels had wings and hands under their wings, Ezekiel 1:8. It may be emblematical of this truth. Christians must not only have the wings of faith to fly, but hands under their wings to work the works of mercy. This is a faithful saying. And these things I will that thou affirm constantly, that they which have believed in God might be careful to maintain good works. Titus 3:8. The lamp of faith must be filled with the oil of charity. Faith alone justifies, but justifying faith is not alone. You may as well separate weight from lead or heat from fire as works from faith. Good works, though they are not the causes of salvation, yet they are the evidences. Though they are not the foundation, yet they are the superstructure. Faith must not be built upon works, but works must be built upon faith. You are married to another, that we should bring forth fruit unto God, Romans 7:4. Faith is the grace which marries Christ, and good works are the children which faith bears. For the vindication of the doctrine of our church and in honor of good works, I shall lay down four aphorisms. First, works are distinct from faith. It is vain to imagine that works are included in faith as the diamond is enclosed in the ring. No, they are distinct, as the sap in the vine is different from the clusters that grow upon it. Two, works are the touchstone of faith. Show me thy faith by thy works, James 2:18. Works are faith's letters of credence to show. If, says St. Bernard, you see a man full of good works, then by the rule of charity you are not to doubt of his faith. We judge the health of the body by the pulse, where the blood stirs and operates. O Christian, judge of the health of your faith by the pulse of mercy and charitableness. It is with faith as with a deed in law. To make a deed valid, there are three things requisite: the writing, the seal, the witnesses. So, for the trial and confirmation of faith, there must be these three things: the writing, the word of God, the seal, the spirit of God, and the witnesses, good works. Bring your faith to this scripture touchstone. Faith justifies works. Works testify faith. Third, works honor faith. These fruits adorn the trees of righteousness. Let the liberality of your hands, says Clemens Alexandrinus, be the ornaments of your faith. Wear it as a holy bracelet about your wrists. I was eyes to the blind, and feet was I to the lame. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My judgment was as a robe and a diadem, Job 29:14-15. While Job was the poor's benefactor and advocate, this was the ensign of his honor. It clothed him as a robe and crowned him as a diadem. This is that which takes off the odium and obloquy and makes others speak well of religion when they see good works as handmaids waiting upon this queen. And number four, good works are in some sense more excellent than faith. In two respects, because they are of a more noble, diffusive nature. And though faith be more needful for ourselves, yet good works are more beneficial to others. Faith is a receptive grace. It's all for self-interest. It moves within its own sphere. Works are for the good of others, and it's a more blessed thing to give than to receive. Good works are more visible and conspicuous than faith. Faith is a more occult grace. It may lie hidden in the heart and not be seen. But when works are joined with it, now it shines forth in its native beauty. Though a garden be never so decked with flowers, yet they are not seen till the light comes. So the heart of a Christian may be enriched with faith, but it is like a flower in the night. It's not seen till works come. When this light shines before men, then faith appears in its orient colors. And now a check to the unmerciful. If this be the effigy of a good man, that he is of a merciful disposition, then it sharply reproves those that are far from this temper. Their hearts are like the scales of the Leviathan, shut up together as with a close seal, Job 41:15. They move only within their own circle, but do not indulge the necessities of others. They have a flourishing estate, but like the man in the gospel, they have a withered hand, and they cannot stretch it out to good uses. They have all as for themselves, not for Christ. These are akin to the churl Nabal. Shall I take my bread and my water and give it to men whom I know not whence they be? 1 Samuel 25:11. It was said of the emperor Pertinax that he had a large empire, but a narrow, scanty heart. There was a temple at Athens which was called the Temple of Mercy. It was dedicated to charitable uses, and it was the greatest reproach to upbraid one with this that he had never been in the Temple of Mercy. Well, it is the greatest disgrace to a Christian to be unmerciful. Covetous men, while they enrich themselves, debase themselves, setting up a monopoly and committing idolatry with mammon, thus making themselves lower than their angels, as God made them lower than his angels. In the time of pestilence, it is sad to have your houses shut up, but it is worse to have your hearts shut up. How miserable is it to have a sea of sin and not a drop of mercy? Covetous hearts, like the Leviathan, are firm as a stone, Job 41:24. One may as well extract oil out of a flint as the golden oil of charity out of their flinty hearts. The philosopher says that the coldness of the heart is a warning of death. When men's affections to works of mercy are frozen, this coldness of heart is ominous and sadly portends that they are dead in sin. We read in the law that the shellfish was accounted unclean. This might probably be one reason, because the meat of it was enclosed in the shell, and it was hard to come by. They are to be reckoned among the unclean, who enclose all their estate within the shell of their own cabinet and will not let others be the better for it. How many have lost their souls by being so saving? There are some who perhaps will give the poor good words, and that's all. If a brother or sister be naked and destitute of food, and one of you say to them, "Depart in peace, be warmed and filled," notwithstanding you give them not those things which are needful to the body, what does it profit? James 2:15. Good words are but a cold kind of charity. The poor cannot live as the chameleon upon this air. Let your words be as smooth as oil. They will not heal the wounded. Let them drop as the honeycomb. They will not feed the hungry. Though I speak with the tongues of angels and have not charity, I'm but as a tinkling cymbal. 1 Corinthians 13:1. It's better to be charitable as a saint than eloquent as an angel. Such as are cruel to the poor, let me tell you, you unchristian yourselves. Mercifulness is the sin of the heathen, Romans 1:31. While you put off the bowels of mercy, you put off the badge of Christianity. Saint Ambrose says that when we do not relieve one whom we see ready to perish with hunger, we're guilty of his death. If this rule hold true, there are more guilty of the breach of the sixth commandment than we are aware of. St. James speaks a sad word, "For he shall have judgment without mercy that hath showed no mercy." James 2:13. How do they think to find mercy from Christ, who never showed mercy to Christ in his members? Dives denied Lazarus a crumb of bread. Dives was denied a drop of water. At the last day, behold the sinner's indictment. "I was hungry, you gave me no meat. I was thirsty, you gave me no drink." Matthew 25:42. Christ does not say, "You took away my meat, but you gave me none. You did not feed my members." And then follows the sentence, "Depart from me, you cursed." When Christ's poor come to your doors and you bid them depart from you, the time may come when you shall knock at heaven's gate and Christ will say, "Go from my door. Depart from me, you cursed." In short, covetousness is a foolish sin. God gave the rich man in the gospel that appellation, "Thou fool." Luke 12:20. The covetous man does not enjoy what he possesses. He embitters his own life. He discretiates himself with care, either how to get or how to increase or how to secure an estate. And what is the issue and result? Often as a just reward of sordid penuriousness, God blasts and withers him in his outward estate. That saying of Gregory Nazianzen is to be seriously weighed. God many times lets the thief take away And the moth consumed that which is injuriously and unmercifully withheld from the poor. Before I leave this matter, I'm sorry that any who pass for honest men should be brought into the indictment. I mean, sorry that any who profess Christianity should be impeached as guilty of this sin of covetousness and unmercifulness. Sure I am that God's elect put on vows of mercies, Colossians 3:12, but I tell you that devout misers are the reproach of Christianity. They are spots in the face of religion. I remember Alien in his history reports that in India, there is a griffin having 4 feet and wings, his bill like the eagle's. It's hard whether to rank him among the beasts or the fowl. So I may say of penurious votaries, they have the wings of profession, by which they seem to fly to heaven, but the feet of beasts, walking on earth and even licking the dust. It's hard where to rank these, whether among the godly or the wicked. Oh, take heed that seeing your religion will not destroy your covetousness, at last your covetousness does not destroy your religion. The fabulist tells a story of the hedgehog that came to the coney burrows in stormy weather and desired harbor, promising that he would be a quiet guest. But when once he had gotten entertainment, he set up his prickles and never left till he had thrust the poor conies out of their burrows. So covetousness, though it has many fair pleas to insinuate and wind itself into the heart, yet as soon as you have let it in, this thorn will never leave pricking till it has choked all good beginnings and thrust all religion out of your hearts. Now persuasions to mercifulness. I proceed next to the exhortation to beseech all Christians to put on vows of mercies. Be ready to indulge the miseries and necessities of others. St. Ambrose calls charity the sum of Christianity. And the apostle makes it the very definition of religion. Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this: to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction. James 1:27. The Hebrew word for poor signifies one that is empty or drawn dry. And so the poor are exhausted of their strength, beauty, substance, like ponds they are dried up. Therefore let them be filled again with the silver streams of charity. The poor are, as it were, in the grave. The comfort of their life is buried. O Christians, help with your merciful hands to raise them out of the sepulchre. God sendeth his springs into the valley, Psalm 104:10. Let the springs of your liberality run among the valleys of poverty. Your sweetest and most benign influence should fall upon the lower grounds. What is all your seeming devotion without bounty and mercifulness? I have known many, says Basil, pray and fast, but relieve not such as are in distress. They are for a zeal that will put them to no charges. What are they the better, says he, for all their seeming virtue? We read that the incense was to be laid upon the fire, Leviticus 16:13. The flame of devotion must be perfumed with the incense of charity. Aaron was to have a bell and a pomegranate. The pomegranate, as some of the learned observe, was a symbol of good works. They lack the pomegranate who have no good works. The wise men not only bowed the knee to Christ, but presented him with gold, myrrh, and frankincense, Matthew 2:11. Pretenses of zeal are insufficient. We must not only worship Christ, but bestow something upon his members. This is to present Christ with gold and frankincense. Isaac would not bless Jacob by the voice, but he feels and handles him, and supposing them to be Esau's hands, he blessed him. God will not bless men by their voice, their loud prayers, their devout discourses. But if he feel Esau's hands, if these hands have wrought good works, then he blesses them. Let me exhort you, therefore, to deeds of mercy. Let your fingers drop with the myrrh of liberality. Sow your golden seed. In this sense, it is lawful to put out your money to use when you lay it out for good uses. Remember that excellent saying of Augustine, give those things to the poor which you cannot keep, that you may receive those things which you cannot lose. There are many occasions of exercising your mercifulness. The poor goes to the wall. Hear the orphan's cry. Pity the widow's tears. Some there are who want employment. It would do well to set their wheel a-going. Others who are past employment, be as eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. In some cases, whole families are sinking if some merciful hand does not help to shore them up. Now, before I press arguments to liberality and munificence, there are three objections that lie in the way, which I shall endeavor to remove. First, we may give, and so in time come ourselves to want. Let Basil answer this. Wells, says he, which have their water drawn, spring ever more freely. The liberal soul shall be made fat, Proverbs 11:25. Luther speaks of a monastery in Austria which was very rich while it gave annually to the poor, but when it left off giving, the monastery began to decay. There's nothing lost by doing our duty. An estate may be imparted, yet not impaired. The flowers yield honey to the bee, yet do not hurt their own fruit. When the candle of prosperity shines upon us, we may light our neighbor that it is in the dark and have nevertheless light ourselves. Whatever is dispersed to pious uses, God brings it in some other way. As the loaves in breaking multiplied, or as the widow's oil increased by pouring out, 1 Kings 17:16. Secondly, I cannot do as much as others, erect churches, build hospitals, augment libraries, maintain scholars at the university. No, if you cannot do so much, yet do something. Let there be much goodwill, though there be not much wealth to go with it. The widow's two mites cast into the treasury were accepted, Luke 21:1-4. God, as Chrysostom observes, looked not at the smallest of her gift, but at the largeness of her heart. In the law, he that could not bring a lamb for an offering, if he brought but two turtle doves, it sufficed. We read that the people brought gold and silver and goat's hair to the building of the tabernacle, Exodus 35:22-24, on which place says Origen, I desire, Lord, to bring something to the building of thy temple, if not gold to make the mercy seat on, if not silk to make the curtains on, yet a little goat's hair, that I may not be found in the number of those that have brought nothing to thy temple. And thirdly, but I do not have anything to bestow upon the necessities of others. Have you anything to bestow upon your own lusts? Have you money to feed your pride, your epicurism, and you cannot find anything to relieve the poor members of Christ? Admit this excuse to be real, that you do not have such an estate, yet you may do something wherein you may express your mercy to the poor. You may sympathize with others. You may pray for them. Speak a word of comfort to them. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem, Isaiah 42. If you can give them no gold, you may speak a word in season which may be as apples of gold and pictures of silver. Nay, more, you may be helpful to the poor in stirring up others who have estates to relieve them. As it is with the wind, if a man be hungry, the wind will not fill him, but it can blow the sails of the mill and make it grind corn for the use of man. So, though you do not have an estate yourself to help him who is in want, yet you may stir up others to help him. You may blow the sails of their affections, causing them to show mercy, and so you may help your brother by a proxy.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at puritandownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at puritandownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan hard drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan hard drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan hard drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan hard drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan hard drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwaters Revival Books.